One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today. And get your old self back naturally.
I'm Kathy with a C.
And I'm Kathy with a K.
And this is Killer Destinations. Today's destination is Louisville, Kentucky. Louisville, Kentucky's largest city, sits on the Ohio River along the Indiana border and is the oldest city west of the Appalachian Mountain Range. It was founded in 1778 by George Rogers Clark and named after King Louis XVI of France. Every May, its racecourse Churchill Downs hosts the Kentucky Derby, a renowned horse race. Think men and women wearing their finest clothing, big hats, and the official drink of the Derby, mint juleps. The racetrack, Churchill Downs, was actually founded by Meriwether Lewis Clark Jr., the grandson of William Clark of the Lewis and Clark Expedition. Louisville is also known for its production of baseball bats, known as the Louisville Sluggers, used in every major league ballpark across the nation. But in 1988, when the glitz and glamour of the Derby eventually faded, Louisville residents hunkered down for the coming winter. And that's when the frozen ground revealed something sinister.
So before we start, we want to say thank you to our listener, Christina, who suggested this case to us.
Thank you, Christina.
We appreciate it. We hope we do it justice. In the early morning hours of Sunday, September 25th, 1998, John and Essie Schaefer were worried. Their daughter hadn't returned home after leaving to visit her fiancé, Mel Ignato, the prior afternoon at his house in Jeffersontown. Their daughter, 36-year-old Brenda Sue Schaefer, lived with her parents even though she owned a condominium in an area in the old Louisville neighborhood of DuPont Square. Brenda was the youngest of six children, and their parents, who were in their 70s, had a number of health issues that required daily care. Her mother had an especially tough time. She had lupus, high blood pressure, heart problems, and was dealing with the aftermath of a stroke. So Brenda chose to live with her parents in the four-bedroom house where she grew up. At 4 a.m., when Brenda still hadn't returned home, they first called Brenda's fiancé, Mel, expecting him to tell them that she'd fallen asleep and would be home in the morning. But he shocked them by saying that Brenda had left his place at 11:30 the night before. Mel lived about 30 miles away from the Schaefer home, so Brenda should have been home by midnight at the latest. Mrs. Schaefer was so frantic to find Brenda that she asked her son Tom and his girlfriend to go to the police station to report that Brenda was missing. And Kath, Mel was so troubled after talking to Mrs. Schaefer that at 4:17 a.m. he called the police where he lived in Jeffersontown to report that Brenda was missing. And it was actually around the same time that Tom Schaefer was talking to the police about his sister where they lived. Now, between these two departments that Tom and Mel spoke with, they decided that the case should be passed to the Jefferson County Police because it was a much larger agency who could handle such a situation. Brenda was described as white, 36 years old, brown eyes and brown hair, 5'4" tall and 110 pounds. She was last seen wearing a light-colored short-sleeve sweater, blue jeans, and red shoes.
Brenda had worked for the past 10 years as a nursing assistant and an x-ray technician for Dr. William Spaulding, a local family doctor. She was a hard worker, rarely taking days off, and working weekends whenever she was asked. The doctor described Brenda as responsible, reliable, and punctual. And he was devastated that she was missing. Brenda did not have an interest in higher education, but she'd already achieved her primary dream of owning her own home.
So, Kath, what was interesting in doing this research about Brenda is that after her disappearance, reading some of these newspaper articles, another issue kept popping up regarding her family. So remember, this is 1988. In 1971, so 17 years prior, there was another story about the Schaefer family. Brenda's older brother, John, was a Louisville police officer, and he was 28 years old, and which would have made Brenda, I believe she was like 19 at the time. So her older brother was John Schaefer Jr. I don't know what the family called him. I always called him John Jr. just because his father's name was John also. And so doing the research, it made it easier. But John Jr. and his partner, Officer Wilbur Hayes, in May of 1971, were responding to a call in a neighborhood about a mile from downtown Louisville called Smoketown. So when they go and respond to this call, they get out of their car, and there are two recent parolees. They were identified later as William and Narvel Tinsley. They ambushed John Jr. and his partner, Officer Hayes, and killed them. So what had happened is Officer Hayes had Narvel in an arm lock, like around his neck, as John Jr. went to handcuff him. But as he did so, William Tinsley came up, the brother of Narvel, pulled a pistol, and shot Officer Hayes twice in the back of his head. Now, when this happened, Narvel was able to get away, and he grabbed Officer Hayes' gun from his belt, and he chased John Jr. around his squad car and shot him three times in his back at near point-blank range as John Jr. tried to draw his pistol. As John begged for mercy, Narvel shot him twice in the top of his head.
That is a nightmare.
Isn't that awful?
That is disgusting.
It absolutely is. So what happened was is these two brothers were convicted and sentenced to death in the case of killing these two officers. It was later commuted to life in prison. And what was discovered a few days after Brenda was reported missing is that one of the brothers, the older one, William, had actually just been paroled after serving 17 years in prison.
Just 17?
Just 17. And the reason for this was, and his brother was too, he just wasn't out yet. They said they changed their lives in prison. They were getting an education. They were studying. They were leading men's groups. They were doing blah, 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 which is great. 17 years isn't enough to atone for two police lives.
No, not in my book.
By the way, when they were paroled, the families, the prosecutors, the police, none of them were informed that William Tinsley had been released. Anyway, so apparently 18 months prior, the father, John Sr., went to a parole hearing and said that before John Jr.'s murder, the family was always together for parties, birthdays, holidays, all of that. And he said, seldom was there a time when we didn't get together. They all just liked each other. He said, we're just not the happy family we were anymore. He had to remove all of his pictures of John Jr. from the house because it was so hard for him.
That is heartbreaking.
It absolutely is. So after finding out that William Tinsley had been released on parole, the FBI and Kentucky police immediately, of course, checked his whereabouts to see if there was some sort of retribution involved. But they were able to determine that he was not involved in Brenda's disappearance. And like I said, his brother Narvel was still in prison pending his release on parole. Now, Tom Schaefer, who was John Jr.'s younger brother and Brenda's older brother, at the time when this was revealed, said, how could two lives be paid for with 17 years when the families of the victims pay for the rest of their lives with their anguish?
Just a few hours after Brenda Schaefer was reported missing, Jefferson County Police found her 1984 Buick Regal parked on the shoulder of westbound Interstate 64. It had a flat rear tire and a broken side window, and the radio had been stolen. And it was clear that someone had also tried to remove the car's speakers but were unsuccessful. Papers were strewn on the floor of the car and in the grass beside it. There was damage to the left rear corner of the trunk lid, and the area around the lock had been pried. The car was covered with morning dew, which to investigators indicated that it had been there for several hours. But nothing was found in or around the car that gave detectives clues as to where Brenda might be or who might have taken her. Almost 3 weeks after she was reported missing, Jefferson County Police and the FBI held a press conference. The FBI told the public that they were involved because they were investigating the case as a possible interstate kidnapping. They also asked for any assistance from the public that might help them determine Brenda's state of mind before she went missing and find any friends or coworkers who could provide additional information. At the press conference, Brenda's brother Tom appealed to the public for information that might help the FBI and the Jefferson County Police find her. He said, 17 years ago, my family lost my brother in a tragic murder. Ever since then, I've wondered if another tragedy struck the family, could we make it through? Well, it has again. I don't know if we can make it without my sister being found. Even if she is not with us anymore, at least we could finalize it, give her a Christian burial, and try to get on with our lives. Jefferson County Police Chief Bobby Crouch revealed at the same press conference that at that point, very little information had been received from the public. This surprised him because Interstate 64 is fairly well traveled even at midnight. So he urged anyone who saw anything unusual, a hitchhiker, another vehicle, or the car itself, to notify police. Chief Crouch said that they were interested in times and locations. Somebody broke into the car and stole the radio and attempted to steal the speakers. So the chief said, because information about Brenda was critical, if that person would come forward, they would discuss the offense and come to a decision that would be beneficial to everyone.
That's really cool.
Very cool. Also, Dr. Spaulding, Brenda's employer, set up a reward fund of $25,000 asking for any information that would lead to her whereabouts. Despite this reward, 4 months after she disappeared, Brenda still had not been found.
So there was still no trace of Brenda Schaefer. No one had tried to withdraw money from her bank accounts or use her credit cards. Her purse was missing, along with a ring, a necklace, and a tennis bracelet she usually wore. And while police found a small amount of blood that was the same as her blood type, they couldn't determine if the blood was actually Brenda's. And of course, remember, this is 1988. The $25,000 reward had only generated crank responses. And we hear this a lot. Like, remember some of the cases we've done?
Right. Like, who are the people who get their kicks by, you know, calling these numbers
and tormenting the family
members?
And so now, we're 5 months after Brenda disappeared, three local police departments and the FBI had interviewed dozens of people, but had not arrested anyone. So according to an article on March 5th, 1989, this is now almost 6 months after Brenda disappeared, journalist Eleanor Brecher wrote in the Courier Journal that everyone had pretty much determined that Brenda's fiancé Mel Ignato was the only logical suspect. He was a marketing executive with a firm that sold water treatment systems and seemed to live a very moneyed lifestyle. He drove a Corvette, owned a 32-foot boat, had a beautiful home and nice clothes, and he wined and dined Brenda and gave her expensive gifts. But friends had divulged that shortly before her disappearance, Brenda told them that she had broken off her engagement to Mel, which he had not shared with police. And he was the last person to see her alive. So, Kath, by the time Brenda met Mel, remember, she was 36 years old when she disappeared, she'd already been married and divorced, and then also been in an 8-year relationship with another man. Now, in both cases, Brenda was young and chose very dominant partners, which resulted in her having low self-esteem, and Mel fell into this same category. He was 16 years older than she was, so he was 51 years old, but his dominance took a worrying turn as he became increasingly possessive of her. Brenda's family actually grew to despise him, Kath, because they felt he was controlling her and they realized he was trying to separate her from her family. In September of 1986, this was 2 years to the day before she disappeared, she met Mel on a blind date. Her best friend and coworker Joyce was dating one of his friends, and they double dated on a river cruise on Mel's 32-foot boat. As we said, Mel was 16 years older. He was also a divorced father of three adult children. Kath, they became engaged 5 months later on Valentine's Day 1987, when Mel gave her a custom-designed diamond ring with a 2.3-carat center stone.
Damn.
When Brenda disappeared roughly 18 months after Mel proposed, they had not yet set a wedding date.
After Brenda's disappearance, the town gossip kicked into overdrive, and Mel was irate that people thought he did it. And he criticized the police, saying they had not done enough to look for the perpetrator. In the same article by journalist Eleanor Brecher, Mel complained about police pressure and said they were victimizing an innocent man who was already devastated by the loss of a loved one. Mel was quoted as saying, "I did not have anything to do with what happened to Brenda. I'm at a loss as much as anyone else." Mel said the last time he saw Brenda was September 24th, and that was the day before she was reported missing. They were planning to visit a boat show and an art fair in a nearby city, but because it was raining, they ended up just driving around in her car. According to Mel, his Corvette was having tire problems, and he didn't want to drive it on wet roads. He said they ate dinner at the Golden Star Chili restaurant before window shopping. I do love me some good chili.
You like white chili, and I won't eat it.
I know. I am a professional white chicken chili cook.
She is, and everybody loves it.
Except Kathy,
except
because
for me.
It made her throw up one time.
No, remember, I came back from Germany, and I had the stomach flu, and so it was just happenstance that I happened to eat your chili that night.
Mm.
But, you know, it's hard to see it twice and really think it's okay to eat again.
So, after eating at the Gold Star Chili restaurant, they went to a bar on the river so they could walk out onto the dock area. Mel and Brenda talked for a while before going back to the car. On their way back to his house, Mel said they stopped at a shopping center to look in the window at a gift shop. He said Brenda dropped him off at his place at 11:30 p.m., then drove home. After he was alone in his house, Mel decided he was hungry again, so he went to another chili place.
This man likes some chili.
Exactly. In a nearby shopping center to get something to eat, then went back home.
Mel said that at 3:30 a.m. the phone rang and it was Mrs. Schaefer, and he was really surprised because Mrs. Schaefer had never called him in the entire time that they'd been dating and engaged, and this time she was calling to find out where Brenda was. And that was also strange because she never even called when Brenda was late getting home, like when he would drop her off late. So when Mrs. Schaefer asked him if Brenda was with him, his first thought was that something had happened to her family. So Mel tells the journalist, at this point, he considered himself an innocent second victim in this case. He called the accounts of a deteriorating relationship vicious gossip and lies motivated by petty jealousy. Jealousy by whom was never addressed. As the months passed, Mel Ignoto remained the prime suspect in the case. As we said, he was the last person to see Brenda alive, but also his alibi wasn't verifiable, and it turned out that he was hiding large debts and tax evasion problems behind his flashy Corvette and nice home. So, the prosecutor for the U.S. Attorney's Office came up with a plan. Kath, you're going to like this. The prosecutor, U.S. Attorney's Office, so big deal, 27-year-old Scott Cox.
He went to Killer Destinations Law School.
I had that same thought.
27-year-old, honestly, that's pretty studly.
Seriously. Prosecutor Cox believed that Mel was desperate to prove himself after he read that Courier Journal article, so Cox called Mel's attorney, a man named Charlie Ricketts, and suggested that Mel could redeem himself if he agreed to testify before a federal grand jury. Now, of course, Attorney Ricketts, who's not in a courtroom, was still hopping up and down.
Right.
Because, sorry, I know that's usually your line. He did not want his client to do this. But as Prosecutor Cox predicted, Mel insisted he wanted to testify and would do anything needed to clear his name. So Kath, his defense attorney Ricketts, made Mel sign a letter saying he understood what he was agreeing to and he was doing it against the advice of counsel.
I am sure that that attorney made it crystal clear. And yeah, sign on the dotted line, buddy. You're being a dum-dum, and I want it forever memorialized that this was your idea.
Exactly. Oh, and by the way, you can't sue me now.
Right, exactly. Yeah, my legal malpractice premium is still good.
So after signing this document on October 16th, 1989, this is now just over a year after Brenda disappeared, Mel Ignoto appeared before the grand jury. Now, Kath, Prosecutor Cox had learned that shortly after Brenda disappeared, Mel had started dating a former girlfriend named Marianne Shore. So some of the questions Cox asked in front of the grand jury were about Mel's relationship with Brenda and his sex life with Marianne.
Which I am sure would not fly, depending how descriptive the questions were or how intrusive, in a regular courtroom. But grand jury, it's
its own animal.
That's correct.
So it didn't sound, Kathy, like any of these were too graphic or too detailed, but it was questions like, how many months from the time Brenda disappeared in September of 88 was he sleeping with Marianne? And Mel responded that it was after the first of the year, so 3 months later, but said it wasn't on a regular basis. He said it was a need on his part for emotional and physical support.
Aww.
I know.
She had pity sex.
Mel also was asked point blank if he killed Brenda, and he said, no, absolutely not. I did not kill her. I would not have laid a finger on that woman. He truly said, on that woman.
Thank you, Bill Clinton.
According to Prosecutor Cox, Mel testified well. He seemed honest and straightforward. However, after this questioning, there was one person that Cox wanted to talk to. And if he was right, he believed her story had the potential to blow the case wide open. It was Mary Ann Shore, the woman Mel started sleeping with shortly after Brenda disappeared.
Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta could make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Just days after Brenda's disappearance, Jefferson County Detective Jim Wesley went to Marianne's house to question her. Detective Wesley asked the obvious questions, her connection with Mel, the last time she saw Brenda, etc., etc., etc. During that conversation, Marianne provided very little to no helpful information regarding Mel. She explained that she had broken up with him back in 1984 because of his lack of interest in marriage. Marianne said Mel simply viewed her as an item of sex and no actual feelings were attached. So just a few months after Mel's grand jury appearance, and at this point they had not indicted, detectives circled back to Marianne. And this time, she divulged information that would change the course of the entire case. Marianne Shore and her lawyer, Jack Vitatow, spoke with Prosecutor Cox. And Kathy could not come up with any reason as to why this was happening now. But it was surmised that Marianne was bitter at Mel for never having married her. So a few hours into the interview, Marianne's attorney pulls the prosecutor aside privately and says, "What if Marianne knows where the body is?" And I'm sure the prosecutor was totally salivating because obviously that would be a slam dunk on a murder conviction. However, Marianne was also known to be a stretcher of the truth. Otherwise known as a liar.
Or a liar, liar, pants on fire.
Exactly. So the prosecutor said she will have to take us directly to the body. And she'll have to tell investigators everything she knows. According to Marianne, weeks before the murder, Mel dug the hole that they would use to bury Brenda. Marianne said Mel gave her a list of things to buy that he would need to use to torture Brenda, and she purchased them. Then just a few days before Brenda went missing, Mel scream tested the house, meaning he had Marianne scream as loud as she could while he stood outside to see if anyone could hear it. Marianne told the prosecutor that Mel had tied Brenda face down to a glass-topped coffee table, raped and sodomized her, then took her to the bedroom afterwards and killed her with chloroform. And Marianne took photos. But she was sure they only showed Mel from the neck down so he could not be identified. After Brenda's death, Marianne and Mel folded her body in half, tied it together, put her in a garbage bag, and placed her in the hole Mel had dug, then buried the body.
Detective Jim Wesley believed that if he could get Marianne to record herself speaking about the body on tape with Mel, that would be enough to arrest him. Detective Wesley, his partner, and Marianne Shore went to her apartment to arrange a meeting between Marianne and Mel. The plan was for Detective Wesley to hide in a closet and come out and arrest Mel when Marianne got him to admit what had happened. Marianne called Mel to arrange a meeting, but Mel actually did not feel comfortable being in the apartment because he thought it might be bugged by the FBI. Mel agreed to meet Marianne in the parking lot of an ice cream shop, so detectives adjusted their plans and put a body microphone on Marianne. All she needed to do was get Mel to admit he killed Brenda or make references to Brenda's murder. At 4:40 in the afternoon, Mel pulled into the parking lot and Marianne got out of her car and into his. She told him that the property behind her house where the grave had been dug had been sold. Mel responded, "Fine, it's been sold. Who's it been sold to?" And Marianne said she didn't know, so Mel said, "Just let it go." But then Marianne asked the question, "But what if they dig it up?" Mel went on a rant for 5 minutes before he responded and said, "That place we dug is not shallow, so don't let it get you rattled." So, Kath, after all this drama of getting Mel and Marianne together, her apartment, his car, whatever, after this conversation, Detective Wesley didn't even know if an arrest could be made because the microphone was underneath Marianne's clothes. It was muffled. And so they weren't sure if they had heard "that place we dug is not shallow" or "that place we got is not shallow," which makes it a very different story, or at least plausible deniability. After this recorded conversation, Mel drove off in his Corvette, and Detectives Wesley and his partner Sharber, Marianne Shore, and FBI agent Deirdre Fike returned back to Marianne's apartment. Now again, with Agent Fike there, Marianne took them through what had happened to Brenda the night she was killed. Kath, she still owned that glass-topped coffee table where Brenda was tied up and raped and sodomized, and took them into her bedroom and showed them the exact same bed where Brenda was killed. Now, I gotta say, honestly, at first, I was like, ick, just get rid of it.
Yeah.
But then I was thinking, if you don't have a lot of money, how do you replace those things? I mean, the coffee table's easier to get rid of, but how do you buy a new bed all of a sudden?
I know.
Or was it was just a kind of her psychopathy because she helped in all this?
Yeah.
I don't know.
At 2:30 that morning, Detective Wesley went to Mel's home and banged on the front door. And when Mel answered it, he was immediately placed in handcuffs. Mel was charged with murder one, pled not guilty, and bail was set at $500,000. So Mel Ignato stayed in jail pending his trial. Brenda's burial site was found the next day by a cadaver dog. After the location where the body was buried was identified by the canine, the county police and evidence technicians began to carefully dig. Brenda's body was pulled up exactly as Marianne had described it, folded in half and tied up inside a garbage bag. On January 11, 1991, more than 3 years after Brenda Schaefer disappeared, the case moved to the office of the Commonwealth's attorney, Ernie Jasmine. Because of all the media attention in Louisville, defense attorney Ricketts successfully made a motion for a change of venue. In order to obtain an unbiased jury, the court moved the case 100 miles northeast to Covington, Kentucky. The Covington jury, including two alternates, was composed of 6 women and 8 men. Just days before Mel Ignato's trial, Marianne Shore pled guilty to tampering with evidence in relation to Brenda Schaefer's murder. Prosecutor Ernie Jasmine's opening statement in the courtroom was very brief. He described Brenda's physical appearance at the time of her disappearance, as well as noting that her car was found the same day she was reported missing. Jasmine also told the jury that the front driver's seat had been adjusted to fit a large man rather than the petite Brenda Schaefer. The bulk of the prosecutor's opening statement involved telling the jury about the secret audio recording between Marianne and Mel. The prosecution also asserted that Marianne was unaware that there would be a murder and that Mel told her he was just going to scare Brenda. the prosecutor then led the jurors through the gory and horrific details of Brenda's last hours on Earth. The prosecutor ended his opening statement by saying, "I expect you to find Mel Ignato guilty, and afterward, I would ask you to sentence the defendant to death."
Defense attorney Ricketts gave his opening statement afterward, hammering on the prosecution's arguments. He argued that there was no physical evidence linking Mel to the murder of Brenda. There were no fingerprints, pubic hair, blood, semen, or abrasions to tie Mel to the murder. Attorney Ricketts also pointed out that the car was vandalized, and it may have been the vandals who moved the car, not Mel. Ricketts mentioned that the public and media put pressure on the police department to come up with a suspect. He also mentioned Brenda's employer, Dr. Spaulding, who insisted that Brenda often work late hours side by side with him. Dr. Spaulding was portrayed as a possessive, jealous person by attorney Ricketts. Ricketts also implied that Marianne was not a reliable source due to her history of theft. And as we had said, Kath, and I don't know if Ricketts mentioned this, she was known about town as a liar. All of Ricketts' claims received objections from prosecutor Jasmine during his opening. This back and forth, though, would be the main rhythm throughout the trial. Attorney Ricketts and prosecutor Jasmine kept going back and forth. Detective Wesley Cathy gave a four-hour-long testimony against Mel. And then, of course, he was cross-examined by defense attorney Ricketts. At the end of the day, Kath, in the prosecution's eyes, all the evidence was there. Mel was going to prison, and prosecutor Jasmine urged the jury to recommend the death penalty. So, Kath, after all the testimony and evidence was out, Kath, it was 11 days that this trial took, the jury finally reached a verdict. Not guilty. And afterwards, Kathy, Detective Wesley had said that he was dumbfounded by this verdict because he felt that that tape that they had made with Marianne and Mel in the car at the ice cream parking lot was obvious, and it seemed that the jury just couldn't put two and two together.
And the fact that she said, right there, that's where she's buried.
And described exactly how it was.
Yeah.
And there's no way she would have been able to do it herself.
Right.
Detective Wesley said all he wanted was to put Mel in jail, and then here Mel was getting away with murder. Detective Wesley said that the biggest disappointment of his career was not putting Mel Ignato in jail. So, Kath, as we all know, legal defenses are really, really expensive.
Yes, they are.
And Mel Ignato, in order to satisfy his legal bills, actually signed his home over to his defense attorney, Ricketts. Ricketts, in turn, then sold the house to a couple who began to renovate the house. In June of 1992, so this is 18 months after Mel was acquitted, the couple began to renovate the living room and decided to install new carpet. So as workers began to pull up the carpet, in one of the corners of the living room, when the workers pulled back the carpet, they discovered an air vent. So after discovering this air vent, Kath, the workers opened the top of the vent and looked inside of it, and there was actually like a zipper storage bag that was inside this vent. So they pulled it out, opened it up, and they found three rolls of undeveloped film and a ring, a necklace, and a tennis bracelet. The new owners knew the history of the house, so they called the FBI and were connected with FBI agent Deirdre Fike. This is the agent who'd been involved in the case. She immediately went to the house to pick up the items. She took the film rolls to the photo lab to develop and recognized the jewelry as belonging to Brenda Schaefer. Once the photo lab was able to develop the film, what they saw changed the course of the Brenda Schaefer murder saga.
The developed images showed Brenda Schaefer tied to a glass-top coffee table, gagged, and in the exact position that Marianne Shore had described. There were a total of 112 photographs, each one getting progressively more vile. And in the background of each of the photos was a nude man. But whoever was taking the pictures, and we assume it was Marianne Shore, had done an excellent job to never show the man above his chest. The FBI and Jefferson County Police knew they had their evidence, but there was one problem. Mel had been acquitted of murder, and because of the double jeopardy clause of the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, he could not be tried twice. And I'm going to defer to Kathy, who's in her first year of Killer Destinations Law School. Can you tell us about the double jeopardy clause, ma'am?
Is that in that show where you get to double the money if you answer the question right?
What's the character in Legally Blonde?
Elle Woods.
That's what I'm going to call you. Go ahead, Elle.
What? Like it's hard? So what I was surprised about, because I wasn't taught this in actually my Fifth Amendment class, right. is that, which doesn't exist, is that I knew that the Double Jeopardy Clause provided protection against being tried twice for the same crime. I did not realize that it actually says that the case must be concluded, but if a jury is deadlocked or a mistrial is declared, that does not constitute conclusion, so you can still be retried. And it makes sense, but I just hadn't thought about it that far.
Right. Like you said, if there's a mistrial, the prosecutor can do it again and again and again and again, honestly, in perpetuity. So after all the evidence had been analyzed and confirmed, Agent Fike, the FBI, and the Jefferson County Police Department headed to Mel's apartment to make an arrest. Mel had been keeping a low profile ever since the murder trial and was definitely not expecting this visit. As they surveilled him, they saw him come out of his apartment and walk towards his car. Agent Fike then ran across the parking lot and handcuffed him and drove him directly to the Louisville FBI headquarters. Now, this is crazy. At the headquarters, he was ordered to strip completely naked, and he basically freaked out and he says, I'm not going to be getting naked in front of Agent Fike, because she was a chick.
Did he like clutch pearls when he said
this? I think he did. I think he did. So the freaking out Mel was presented with a court order that essentially said, ha, 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 you have to strip down in front of FBI agent Fike.
That's hysterical. Ha, ha.
I know.
And the sucks to be you.
I think the judge signed it like na, 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 something yeah. like that. Exactly. So anyway.
That's just the version we saw, but we can't really confirm that.
Exactly. It wasn't a conformed court copy. So once all the photographs of the various positions were taken, they were compared to the photos that were developed from the rolls found in the air vent at Mel's former house, and the pictures matched up perfectly.
However, like we said, Mel Ignato could not go to prison for Brenda's murder after being found not guilty. So the prosecutor's office did kind of an end run around that and filed the only charges they could. When Mel testified before the federal grand jury 5 months after Brenda disappeared, he took an oath to tell the truth and said, I did not kill Brenda Sue Schaefer. Because he lied under oath, he would be charged with perjury. Having been finally proven to be a murderer, just over 4 years after Brenda Schaefer disappeared, Mel actually confessed to her murder in the U.S. Attorney's Office in front of the Schaefer family. Kath, tragically, Brenda's parents were not there because they had both died before the trial. Brenda disappeared in 1988. Her mother died in 1990. Her father died in 1991. And this trial was in 1992.
They were watching. They knew.
They absolutely were.
They knew.
After confessing at the U.S. Attorney's Office, Mel later went to the federal courthouse and made his confession in front of a judge. He was sentenced to 8 years in federal prison for perjury. And Kath, most of this information that we've gotten till now was from a site we cited at once, was juryverdicts.net. Now, this was an interesting site because the information on there was a combination, specifically to this case, it was a combination of court records. There was a very extensive book written on the subject by a man named Bob Hill, and it included later interviews with some of these key players, like Detective Wesley and Prosecutor Scott Cox. But the story doesn't end here. Mel served 5 of his 8-year federal sentence due to the time he'd already spent in prison awaiting his murder trial. He was released from federal prison in October 1997. Now, after he was released, he was prosecuted a second time for perjury. And this time, it was the state who did the prosecuting. So, a little bit of a background here, Kath. A few months after Brenda disappeared, her employer, Dr. Spaulding, had apparently sent a letter to Mel saying, if you don't reveal where Brenda is, I'm going to send Cuban hitmen to your front door.
Okay. Wow. And then he signed it. The doctor.
Exactly. So Mel Ignato wanted him prosecuted for making terroristic threats. So they go to the courthouse and Mel got on the stand and said, he did this, he did that. I didn't kill her. He's doing all these things. He's threatening me. I'm innocent. Okay. At the end of the day, because the feds and the state didn't want to prosecute the doctor, the judge imposed a $300 fine, and the case was dismissed.
Did the doctor pay it in pennies?
I think he just whipped out 3 bennies and just was like, here, it's my petty cash for the week. You know? But because Mel testified under oath in that case and insisted he did not kill Brenda, the state now got a turn to say, this is a different case that you testified in. This isn't federal court. We're not prosecuting you twice. So the state went after him for perjury, and they did it successfully. Mel was sentenced to 9 years in state prison for perjury and was labeled a second-degree persistent felony offender. He was released from prison for the second time in December 2006. He returned to Louisville and moved into an apartment just 4 miles from the house where he murdered Brenda. Almost 2 years later, in September 2008, Mel Ignotta was found dead in his apartment. He was 70 years old. An autopsy determined that he died from an accidental fall after he tripped and fell onto his glass-top coffee table and bled to death.
Now that is irony.
Karma or irony?
Probably both.
Thank you all for listening. We hope you like the case. As we said at the beginning, this was a case suggested to us by Christina. So I wanted to read the email that she sent to us. She sent it to our email address, killerdestinationspodcast@gmail.com. And she said, I hope this is where I can suggest a case that really frustrated me when I was a teen. Louisville, Kentucky, September 1988, murder of Brenda Sue Schaefer is a double jeopardy case. You gals are awesome podcasters. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I feel you would deliver on this case. This lived in my brain rent-free for years. So, Christina, we hope you delivered on it.
We hope we did it justice.
Engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.